Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A couple months ago, President Obama announced plans for a handful of tech manufacturing hubs in the United States. Manufacturing, he said, is the way to create jobs and keep America competitive.
These manufacturing hubs have the potential to fundamentally change the way we build things in America. So 10 years from now, 20 years from now, imagine our workers manufacturing materials that used to be science fiction. A sheet of metal that's thinner than paper but as strong as steel.
But innovation costs money, and not everyone is convinced that the funding should come from the government. Joining me now by phone from Northern Virginia is senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and founder and chairman of Applied Predictive Technologies, Jim Manzi. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Your recent article in the journal National Affairs considered government's role in innovation. Your point of view was significant because you are not a big government type of guy. Why is the issue of innovation different?
Well, I think if you look throughout American history all the way back to the founding, there has been a special role that government's played to support innovative industries. I think that the base innovation policy of the United States has always been no policy, that is to allow free markets to innovate. But from the 1790s through the current era, the government has played a very specific, what I call overlay role, particularly investing in visionary technologies that are too broad scale or have benefits too diffuse or too long term to be funded by private sector.
You wrote that Alexander Hamilton kind of carried the flag for that back in the day. What back then were they talking about when it came to government funding for innovation?
Well, what's striking is when you read and get past the slightly antiquated language, mm-hmm. how incredibly modern the arguments seem. It could be something you'd be reading in Washington, D.C. in 2014. In that era, manufacturing was the high-tech sector of the day. Hamilton argued that we ought to implement tariffs to raise money and use that to subsidize growth of manufacturing. His argument for why we ought to do that was what UN in modern terms call a series of externality arguments, that the whole country would be better off if we did that. The arguments against him were what we would call today public choice arguments, which were basically that you would end up with the opportunity for corruption and for, at the time, what was a huge issue, which is sectional favoritism between the North and the South.
And did that come to be to a certain degree?
To a certain degree, the tariffs were implemented. Generally speaking, the direct subsidies that he argued for were not. And what happened over time is actually the tariffs grew to much larger proportions than Hamilton had imagined. It actually took specific investments that Congress authorized over the next several decades to create some of the benefits that he talked about, investing in a telegraph line, investing in certain roads and canals, et cetera. So it didn't play out exactly as he imagined it. There were a lot of Democratic compromises, but in very broad terms, it was pretty much as Hamilton described.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Jim Manzi. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and founder and chairman of Applied Predictive Technologies. We're talking about the role of federal government in the development of innovative technologies. If you have a question or comment, point of view about this, you can join the conversation. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So many innovations, medicine, technology, started with the military. Everybody who graduates from West Point, I learned, has a degree in engineering. I didn't know that. Why is that?
Well, West Point was originally established to support what was called the Armory System, which was an attempt to develop, a successful attempt, as it turns out, to develop an indigenous engineering capability in the United States so that we would not be reliant upon European technology and expertise in order to build bridges, provide logistical support for armed forces, and essentially fight wars.
Were there private companies at the time that were trying to move in this direction anyway?
There were, to a degree. The early American Republic had a much different economy than we do today. So there were many fewer what we would think of as large companies. There were many more in proportion to that section of the economy, independent entrepreneurs. There was very little primary technology development that happened in the United States in that era, and actually for a long time afterwards. So the United States, for a very long time, essentially used European scientific breakthroughs and applied them to develop technology. In that era, the late 18th century into the early 19th century, probably the leading application of that was the armories that were supported by the military. The first place that you saw a huge breakout of what we would think of today as true private sector technology were mills and related technologies in New England, most of which, by the way, was technology literally stolen from the United Kingdom.
So when did that start to change? When did the United States come to the fore in technological development?
Generally speaking, by around 1850, there were certain sectors of the American manufacturing economy, which, again, you could think of as the way we think of high tech today, that had become world-leading. But it was only in certain sectors. The British did a famous trade mission in that era to look at what was called, at the time, the quote-unquote, the American system of manufacturers. By the late 19th century, the United States was clearly a major industrial economic power. By the early 20th century, it had become the leading economy in the world, although in many respects, there were still large industrial sectors that were more advanced technologically in Europe.
How much of that progress, if you will, was driven by the easy access to natural resources?
Well, that's a longstanding debate, and I don't think there's a simple answer to that that has that all scholars of the period, and I'm not a scholar, would agree to. It is certainly the case that natural resource endowment helps in general and helped the United States, but it is not the case that, for example, the sectors, the geographies inside the United States with the greatest natural resource endowments industrialize fastest. It is also, if you look internationally, not the case that geographies internationally with the greatest natural resource endowments industrialize fastest or best. So I don't think it's certainly not as simple as saying the United States was blessed with natural resources and that causally explains why industrialization happened here.
What about, I guess it was Abraham Lincoln's decision to build the railroads to the extent that he did? What does transportation have to do with our ability to develop along these lines?
Well, it was enormous, and actually there was very large-scale build-out of railroads prior to the Lincoln presidency.
Okay.
What happened in the Lincoln presidency was the fact of the Civil War and the need to mobilize the military, and also the fact that there was no longer Southern representation in the United States Congress, which was the key source of resistance to build out of lots of infrastructure, meant that it accelerated extraordinarily rapidly under Lincoln. There's a famous historian of American business and economy named Chandler who argues persuasively, I think, that it was the build out of the railroads that was one of the most, if not the most important factor in creating a national level market in the United States. You could now move food much more economically to many more parts of the country, as an example, which allowed the U.S. to develop scale advantages in building out our industrial economy and was central to creating the economy we had by 1900, which was, at that point, world-leading.
Did, likewise, the construction of the interstate highway system have the same sort of impact?
It certainly had a large impact. How you would compare it in terms of percent of GDP growth impact to build out of railroads, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. But there was a defense element to the build-out of the interstate system.
Yeah, it was certainly part of the stated justification, and I think most people believe part of the true rationale, although it's clear that for many of the members of Congress who voted for it, that was a way to market it in addition to its benefits for, building out commerce, congressional district by congressional district. So I think that's part of the reason why it was built. Sure.
Back in the days when this old American system of federal funding for innovation was taking root and taking shape, were there arguments about it along the way like there are today?
Yeah, there were arguments that are almost exactly like the arguments today.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you go back literally to the congressional debates in the time of Hamilton, probably the best, the most eloquent and effective person on the other side of the debate from Hamilton was James Madison, who is not a dumb guy. Mm-hmm. And the arguments are incredibly modern. And those same arguments occur again and again and again throughout American history, really starting from essentially the month the Constitution was signed to today.
I don't know. Sometimes when I hear about these guys and what they were talking about back then, it kind of gives me the chills. I mean, it's sort of amazing. I agree that their arguments were incredibly sophisticated and modern in their substance, and the language wasn't that much different.
Yeah, that's right. It was and it's more eloquent, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
it's kind of humbling, actually, in fact, to go back and read this for people who think economics is a progressive science.
Yeah, yeah. When do you think the old American system, because you wrote about the new American system in your article, when did the old American system fall apart? Why?
Well, you know, one of the arguments I'm making is at some level of abstraction, it is one common approach that has roots all the way back to the foundation of the Republic. And mm-hmm. so what I'm talking about as the new American system is at a certain level of abstraction, as they say, would be very familiar to Abraham Lincoln. I think that the disconnect, and the reason I wrote this, disconnect I saw between, or at least perceived between, the policy debate as I was hearing it in Washington, D.C., and what I was seeing on the ground as an information technology entrepreneur, was that in the application of this system in the post-World War II period was very centered on large-scale institutions. My first job out of school was working at Bell Labs, mm-hmm. Which is almost the paradigmatic example of big company, mass institution, government-related, drive technology change through, it's oversimplifying to say this, but through a command and control system. And what I believe strongly happened is by the 1970s and 1980s, the ability of that system to innovate rapidly, particularly in information technology, but as I argue also, as we've seen recently in the energy economy and the biotech economy and elsewhere, not everywhere, but in a lot of sectors, those large institutions could no longer make technological progress as fast as lots of small startups. And so what I'm arguing is we need to apply the concepts of the American system to an economy where innovation, the center of gravity of innovation has moved decisively to relatively smaller, more nimble competitors in many fields, though not all.
So the nature of American innovation has changed.
I believe that's true, yes. You know, if you look at the sectors where we're creating rapid innovation, information technology, broadly defined, energy is actually an incredibly good example where there's been a sudden breakout of innovation, certain parts of biotech. I think that the contemporary system for doing that or ecology for doing that has certain parts. You have small, innovative companies that are actually driving core parts of the innovation. You have independent financing entities. And by that, there's a lot of different flavors of that, but it basically means not money center banks. Mm-hmm. You know, it's venture capital firms, specialized financial institutions for the energy sector, et cetera. You also do have large established competitors. The big companies have an important role to play in it. And the government is the fourth part of it. And the government has a very specific role that it plays in those sectors very consistently. It is investing in visionary technologies. It's investing in kind of base technologies that are then exploited by the system I'm describing. And I just think that pattern occurs over and over in seemingly different industries where we are seeing good technological progress.
Some critics say that the government, the way it operates today, will tend to favor the big companies with the lobbyists, and that the little guy is still going to be at a great disadvantage regardless in competing with the big guys.
They're exactly correct. I mean, I think there's just no question that there's a huge bias on the part of anytime you have a honeypot of money the government is giving out, if it's big enough, people with resources are going to go after the honeypot of money. I think there's no question about that. I think that has implications for what the government should be doing and shouldn't be doing. I think that the idea of the government, any government entity, and in fact, frankly, any very large company, trying to play venture capitalist and pick, you know, this company is a good bet for public money because they're building solar cells this way as opposed to that company, is a sure recipe for failure over time. On the other hand, when the government can do things that no private company could realistically do, like let's get a man to the moon and bring him back, mm-hmm. That is an appropriate role.
Can you give an example of something today that you're talking about? The man in the moon thing, now it's a man on Mars or a woman on Mars. But what about technology? Are we talking about maybe battery development, the whole battery issue, or what?
So, I mean, I think that there are large-scale civilian institutions that could be repurposed for this. To go to the point you're making, there are large national Department of Energy laboratories that, in my observation, are adrift in the way Bell Labs was adrift when I worked there, you know, 20 plus years ago. And part of the problem is they do not have sufficient focus, and part of the problem is they don't have sufficient independence. So, for example, if we took one of the national energy laboratories and said, you have one goal. Your job is to get the true per unit energy cost from a solar cell all in below that of coal. And we're going to give you a lot more flexibility in how you accomplish that, but we're going to measure your performance against that goal. And we took another national energy lab and said, your job is to get the true all in with regulation costs of nuclear down below that of coal. I think we'd make real progress. I think if we took the National Institutes of Health, which is an enormous, complicated, and in certain ways very productive institution, and took it from 27 programs, none of which, many of which, do not have sufficient focus. Say, we're going to take several broad disease states and, you know, combine multiple programs together and say, your job is to create the following progress against Alzheimer's. I think we could see rapid progress. I think if NASA went from a highly disparate, and in my view at this point, desultory and dysfunctional organization, which used to be able to do great things, and said, your job is to lead an international manned mission to Mars, I think we'd see great progress. And you may choose, you know, careful research might lead you to different goals than the ones I'm giving illustratively, but I think that's the way we could use these assets to make real progress.
My guest is Jim Manzi, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and founder and chairman of Applied Predictive Technologies. We're talking about the role of big government in the development, in innovation and innovative technologies. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. We continue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. To one degree or another, the U.S. government has always been involved in funding innovative technologies, from the telegraph to the internet to the Human Genome Project. And there's always been disagreement about the extent to which government should be involved in innovation. That's what we're talking about today. Coming up, we'll hear from the Battelle Institute about its collaborations with the federal government. Still with us by phone from Northern Virginia is Manhattan Institute Senior Fellow and Founder and Chairman of Applied Predictive Technologies, Jim Manzi. Thanks again, Jim, for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Joining us now by phone from Washington is American Enterprise Institute resident scholar Stan Voiger. Stan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. What do you see, Stan, as the role of government in industry and innovative technology? Should it have a role? Does it have a place?
I think the government, even the federal government, has an important role in supporting education, especially higher education, if we're talking about R&D and innovation. I think it has a crucial role to play in sort of basic science and R&D, and maybe also more on the applied technology and engineering side, especially in areas that touch upon the sort of the core tasks of the federal government, like defense, and at this point probably education and medicine as well.
What about, that's something, Jim Manzi, we didn't bring up, was higher education.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that one of the things that I argue is if you look in practical terms about how innovation has worked and created productivity gains across the U.S. economy in the last 20 years for sure, a lot of it boils down to taking the IT opportunities created by Moore's Law, the ability to process information much faster, and apply them and figure out ways to re-engineer activities. And I think that the government, education, and medical delivery sectors are collectively like 30% of the workforce or our economy, and they've resisted the application of these techniques because they're politically directed. I think that there is a big opportunity to kind of free up those sectors, allow them to operate in a more market-like fashion, which will create innovation in them, which in and of itself is a good thing because they're such big sectors. And also, I think to Stan's point, will enable innovation and growth in other sectors because, for example, you'll have better educated people.
We talked earlier, Stan Voigger, about the difference between the cultures of large companies, corporations, and large sector operations, and the startups culture that has emerged in recent years, in recent decades. What about that, and how we'll find balance in government funding of different projects across that continuum?
Well, look, I think I'm always a bit skeptical of efforts to recreate, you know, startup cultures and, you know, individuals just trying to find their way within the context of large government bureaucracies. I just don't think the incentives are typically set up that way. I don't think people get rewarded the way they would in a pure private sector setting. So I think that, you know, even though the culture has brought a lot of innovation, a lot of benefits, a lot of advantages, I think it's a bit utopian to try and copy that culture, that attitude, those incentives to a public setting.
But Jim Manzi, is that what you're talking about? Is recreating?
No, I mean, I've spent my life basically, or my career as an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. And I think that it is completely utopian to imagine that inside the Department of X in some government agency, or even, to be honest, in a large private sector corporation, you're gonna have entrepreneurial behavior at any significant scale. What I'm describing is introducing mechanisms of, you know, choice, exit, the ability for entrepreneurial organizations to provide services and education, and allow something much more market-like to evolve. An example in education. To allow faster progress. Things like choice in education, I think, are a part of a solution to allow faster innovation and productivity gains in the education sector.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the role of government in technological innovation in the United States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Stan Voigger, in what ways does government hinder innovation? Because when I asked you at the outset, what do you see as the role of government and industry? You sort of ran the gamut and where government could pitch in. So where should it step out?
I think it should step out of, as Jim just said, I think it should try to step out of reasonably large parts of the healthcare sector, of education as well. I think it should try to retreat from activities where it's more directly involved in, you know, setting up manufacturing labs, or, you know, organizing industry-wide organizations that I think typically end up providing benefits to large incumbents as opposed to smaller startup firms. I think that the mere fact that you have a complicated regulatory environment and tax environment, no matter what the substantive context, the content of, you know, the regulations and the tax policies, I think, helps large incumbent organizations that are better at, you know, dealing with accounting rules, or, you know, having a big staff of lawyers around. I think it helps them over small entrepreneurial firms. So I would, you know, so there's some sectors where I think the government has overreached a lot, and I think more generally, a complicated regulatory framework and the kind of invasive tax code that come with a sizable public sector, I think, hamper innovation a lot.
No one would argue that regulations are complicated, but usually regulations come out of a problem from an industry, whether it's a pollution, you know, it's usually environmental, often environmental. It's harmful to humans. How do you grow regulation in a way that protects people but is simpler?
Well, I think one way to do it would be to have a lot of regulation sunset automatically, as opposed to, you know, always just piling on. Mm-hmm. I think that would be helpful. It would, you know, force legislators to reconsider regulation they've enacted in the past, as opposed to, you know, only considering new regulation. I think that would be a good procedural move toward an environment where you aren't just constantly adding to the complexity of the system.
Jim Manzi?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, I started a company in, like, the spare bedroom of my apartment, which is now a reasonably large global company. And along the way, I would say that the effects that Stan Scrimer wants that I've definitely seen, which is regulatory complexity and especially tax complexity definitely advantages large companies because you can figure out the 10 angles you can work to win at it. I'd say that in general, pretty much anything that government entities ever try to do to help us basically was useless. It wasn't negative either, but it was pretty much useless. The one thing that we had to have, and it was a function of the kind of company we were building, was dark fiber, which is to say backbone fiber optics cables that were built out actually very much like the canals got built out hundreds of years ago, or the railroads got built out 100 years ago, where you had this huge burst of investment. You then had a collapse of the industry, and you therefore had low-cost infrastructure, which is the modern version of the telegraph line or railroads that we could exploit. And it was that kind of investment, ultimately, that created opportunities for us to grow. So it was much less do 10,000 micro things better and much more investments in visionary infrastructure that actually created the sector of the software industry that we're in.
We talk a lot about, at least on this show, about the transportation sector of the United States, and there's a lot of conflict over that these days, particularly when it comes to mass transit. We talked earlier, Stan Voiger, about you know, when the railroads were built and the mass investment how that mass investment brought about innovation. Now people say it's old-fashioned to think about mass transit in those ways. Do you agree, or what do you make of that?
I'm not sure about that. So I guess the argument would be something along the lines of the government should be building broadband internet connections as opposed to railroads and highways. I feel that if you look at the current state of, say, internet access, you know, mobile phone access, 4G networks, I would say those have performed a lot better over the last 10 years by themselves than highways and railroads. I mean, if you were gonna spend a ton of money on one of the two, I'd probably go for the highways, the railroads, the airports. I'm not sure that I entirely agree with that argument. I mean, people still have to move around; that they can't, you know, creep through the tubes that the internet consists of.
Jim Manzi.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you look at, you know, physical infrastructure in the United States, first of all, one should always be skeptical of, you know, the Society of Civil Engineers who make money building bridges and tunnels say you need to build more bridges and tunnels.
Well, that's usually what it is, but yeah, go
right,
ahead.
Right. That said, you know, when you look at independent rankings of American physical infrastructure, as recently as 10 years ago, we were in the top 10 in the world, and now we're about 25th. So there has been real deterioration of physical infrastructure, and it requires, in my opinion, some investment. I think that when you think about two classes of infrastructure investment, one is where the technology is stable, roads, bridges, et cetera, and the other, Stan's talking about where the technology itself is evolving. Our approach to the second class of infrastructure in the United States has historically been one that seems messy and sloppy in the short run, but in the long run works better, which is rather than trying to do a lot of direct standard setting and direct government build out, what you do is the government establishes loose standards, it makes certain kinds of investments, but it allows markets to figure out where to deploy capital against things like, well, do we want more landline investment and more high-speed landline internet access, or do we want more mobile telephony investment? And I think the more we let markets sort out that side of how that infrastructure gets built out, the better off we're going to be. As much as it always seems wasteful and stupid over any 5-year period, over a 30- or 40-year period, it works better.
Let's talk about the speed of knowledge and how we're acquiring knowledge at the speed that we are. If we stand still in a sector, can we ever catch up? In other words, we were talking earlier about manned flights to Mars versus manned flights to the moon. NASA is standing still right now. It's in disarray, as you mentioned, Jim Manzi. How long can an entity like the United States stand still on something and be able to catch up?
Well, you know, in theory, you can always catch up.
Right.
But it's an incredibly self-destructive thing to do, to be at the frontier of the economy and allow yourself to be bypassed. In theory, you can always catch up again. But in my view, it would be a crazy thing for us to voluntarily do that.
Stan Voiger?
I don't know. I think, I mean, in a certain sense, catching up is easier than moving ahead where no one else has gone before.
Okay.
I mean, if you're just copying what other people are doing, you know, it's
which is where we kind of started out at the beginning of the Republic. We were kind of copying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's where China started at, maybe possibly still is. It's where, you know, India still is. So I don't believe in these irreversible, okay, now we're doomed forever scenarios.
Okay.
But you know, I mean, it's harder once you, I mean, there may be national security concerns you want to take into account, where once you're subjected to actual physical power of a counterparty, you know, it may be harder to get away from that. But beyond that, I don't think the goal should be to try and remain one step ahead of everyone in every single subsector and have the most beautiful plastic bags you can possibly think of.
Yeah, I mean, this is Jimmy, and I certainly agree with that. You can have an extreme fetishism about this, but I think that if you want to maintain living standards in the United States that are, you know, very high, if you look at where the good jobs are created in the U.S., places where on a sustained basis people can really make a good living, it tends to be in scale-up phase around new development. So you develop some new technology with a bunch of entrepreneurial companies, and then you get to the point where you now have to build up big computer companies, big biotech companies, big pharma companies, big energy these days. And the thing is, if you're not feeding the front end of that pipeline with those innovations, it's going to be very hard to create those scale-up companies that create all the jobs for the market research managers and the clinical trials administrators and all the people who make good upper middle class livings. I think we're really going to be in a very bad way if we lose that pipeline of innovation that ultimately creates those good jobs.
I want to thank you both for joining us. Jim Manzi, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and Founder and Chairman of Applied Predictive Technologies. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
We will have a link to Jim's article on the website at WOSU.org/allsides. And also Stan Voiger, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Ann.
Stan Voiger, he's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Coming up, we'll hear from the Battelle Institute about its role with the United States government in innovative technologies. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Today we're talking about the role of government in innovative technologies. We've heard the pros and cons of government involvement. Joining us now from Pittsburgh is Senior Director of Battelle Technology Partnership Practice, Simon Tripp. Welcome to the show, Simon.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on.
So almost 85 years ago, the Battelle Memorial Institute was founded on the vision that business and scientific interests can work together for the common good. Was that considered big government investing in innovation?
I think it was viewed from both perspectives. I think there was certainly a heavy corporate emphasis on that. Very early work at Battelle was around commercial technologies with Xerox technology, for example. But, you know, it's a complex ecosystem of innovation in the United States. And the federal government has an extraordinarily important role to play.
What percentage of Battelle's work is government funded? Do you keep track?
Yeah, of course. They're a very important customer. Mattel last year did $5.4 billion in revenues, and about 90% of our revenues have the federal government as a customer. So it's an incredibly important component of our business. We operate and manage six of the large U.S. Department of Energy national laboratories that are doing fundamental research and applied research in America's energy future and innovation in energy. So it's a very important component of our business.
It sounds like the operation that the government funds with Battelle is a lot like what Jim Manzi was talking about, where there's still that innovative edge, there's still the independence.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, these are hard scientists in physics and biosciences and a range of different disciplines looking at fundamental questions. And a lot of that's only work, really, that government-funded research can do, because it's often done not with a particular commercial opportunity in mind. It's done to pursue fundamental knowledge expansion, and it's only that sort of fundamental expansion in knowledge that leads to the new platforms that later on, down the line, lead to new industries being developed. And we saw that with the Human Genome Project and the government investment in that, and the great big growth of genomics that has occurred out of that. There's any number of examples. I mean, to us, we see that government really spurs innovation along five primary pathways. They spur innovation by doing it itself through the Department of Energy labs, National Institutes of Health labs, DARPA, the military labs. So doing it is one way government does it. Funding it, of course, is incredibly important. Funding into our research universities and into other institutes and organizations that are performing research. Buying it, buying the output of innovation. Government's often a very early adopter and of innovation, particularly within the military and the aerospace sector. Incentivizing it through things such as R&D tax credits, the SBIR program, and others that are designed to help the innovation sector grow. And then facilitating the general environment by supporting education, of course, critically important to have that can support innovation, but also through protecting it, through patent protection, through trade protection. So, you know, it's a very complex innovation ecosystem that's at work, and the government is a very important component of it, particularly in the early stage activity where industry typically would not be playing. We do annually the Global R&D Forecast, jointly with R&D Magazine. In the U.S. R&D investment, you certainly can't discount the importance of industry. Industry does 71% of R&D investment in the United States. Federal government and its funding of academia accounts for another 13% on the academia side and 8% direct federal government research. But it's that sort of fundamental nature of that research, the fact that a lot of that work industry would not be doing, but then later takes that output of research and does things with it to spur innovation that's so critically important.
We were talking earlier about the tendency for government, you know, one big organization to tend to want to invest in another big organization. Battelle's become a venerable institution. How do you keep the edge that innovation requires at an organization like Battelle to keep it fresh and innovative and independent and all that sort of thing, instead of always looking for the next federal investment dollar?
Yeah, well, that comes down to the individuals, right? I mean, we've got 22,000 people, and they're spread across 60 locations globally. And we're all working on different projects. You know, as you said in the lead-in, that I'm based in Pittsburgh.
Right.
I'm pretty independent in the work that I'm doing, and so are many of our scientists. I don't think we lack that edge.
Okay.
We also do a lot of business with corporate clients. So I was just recently working with a big Japanese corporation on their work in material sciences and life sciences. So, you know, we keep our edge that way as well by working both with industry and with universities and other organizations and with government.
What's the process like to get government funding? Is the relationship so long term with Battelle now that it's not like you're writing grants every other day? I mean, do they come to you?
Well, there's a mix, right? And that's not really my area of mm-hmm. Battelle, so I might say the wrong thing here. but the government, the big contracts are the national lab management contracts, and those are bid on a competitive basis. I think it's every 5 years, but I might be wrong on that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, certainly it's not, you know, guaranteed. We have to work very hard to make sure that our performance in managing the labs is up to par, and that's all track. So we do have a very good success rate in winning our repeat bids on projects. And my time at Battelle, we've added two national labs to the roster with inside Battelle. So we're having great success on that front. And these are, you know, America's signature institute. As the world looks at places like Brookhaven National Lab and Oak Ridge National Lab and Lawrence Livermore, and these are seen as signature places by the rest of the world. They're the envy of other countries. And other countries are playing catch-up. I mean, the Chinese are investing extremely heavily in research. And our predictions show that by 2020, they may actually overtake the United States in terms of total R&D funding.
My guest is Simon Tripp. He's Senior Director of Battelle Technology Partnership Practice. He's talking to us from Pittsburgh, where he works. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We were talking earlier about the idea of catch-up versus cutting edge. And if you look at something like NASA, a lot of people think it's just sitting back now on its haunches. It doesn't have the funding to go forward and be cutting edge anymore. How do we develop those manned flights to Mars, for instance, that people dream about now that the moon's been conquered, I guess. There was a conversation earlier about, well, is it necessarily bad to be catching up? And you just mentioned China is. That's not so bad to be in a position of trying to catch up.
Well, it means you're not going to be, if you're playing catch up, you're not going to be the early innovator and the early producer of technologies. So you miss out on major opportunities around a particular industry. So if we take the Human Genome Project as an example, mm-hmm. you know, it's grown into, it was a $3.8 billion project. It's grown into a really significant industry. I think our last look at the Human Genome Project found that it had a total impact of $277 million, or rather 277,000 jobs in the United States, and a total output of $64 million just in 2012 alone. So the billion rather. So the return on investment has been really significant, and I think what you see there is that you have fundamental research spurred by government funding that then has led to the development of a large-scale industry that's located in the United States. So with the Genome Project, it was funded largely by the United States, but also the British government was a funder as well through the Wellcome Trust. And when you look at the genomics industry, it's largely headquartered in the UK and in the United States. That fundamental government investment in performing the basic science led to the growth of the industry here. So if we're going to sit back and play catch-up, well, the growth of the next generation of industries would be in China or would be in India. And it's seldom good to be a follower. Your profit margins are less likely to be as strong. You saw what happened with the collapse of the Japanese economy, where they had been less than innovative and had been following. Mm-hmm. So I think it's critically important. It's where America's future lies. I think there's also a sort of fundamental misunderstanding in this, in the way people look at innovation in the United States. And I don't think we have sort of this debate that goes on before, should it be private sector, should it be government? Mm-hmm. It's an oversimplification of a very complex issue. And it actually does the nation a very real disservice. I mean, if you look at the origins of Apple, and I would certainly hold Apple Computer up as a company that's a paragon of entrepreneurial excellence in the United States and of the free enterprise system. But if you talk to folks at Apple, they're going to tell you that when you look at the first generation of the iPod that came out, the click wheel technology in it came from government-related research. The RAM cache in it came from government research. The lithium-ion batteries came from DOE research. The liquid crystal display, microprocessors from DARPA. I mean, it goes on and on. Mm-hmm. And as you come through to the latest versions of the iPod, where you start to get GPS in there and cellular technology, these all have their roots in government-sponsored research. Google, the fundamental algorithms for it were funded through an NSF grant at Stanford University. So, I think it's does a disservice to the country when people talk about, this should all be done by private industry, because even private industry doesn't think that way. Private industry knows that it's that government-sponsored research and university research using government funding provides many of the fundamental advances that are needed to build their industries in the first place.
How does, just take the algorithms that you talked about for Google, how does it get from a research position at Stanford University to Google?
Right. So the founders of Google were at Stanford. If it's funded by government research, the Bayh-Dole Act covers the requirement for the transfer of technology. So the university would own the intellectual property and would license the intellectual property to a company. It's often the case that company would be founded often by university faculty or by graduate students in the case of an entrepreneurial company. So Stanford would be receiving royalties based on the intellectual property that they would own related to the algorithm. And that's the case all over the country, that universities are transferring technology to private industry through licensing agreements of research that was done using federally funded dollars.
Some people worry about government funding risky ventures. Is that way oversimplifying as well what risk is?
Yeah, it is. Is doing fundamental research risky? It's risky if you're only doing fundamental research because you're particularly wanting to have a commercial outcome, because it's not done with a commercial outcome in mind. When you're doing particle physics related research, for example, that's researchers looking to make fundamental discoveries. They're not doing it for commercial reasons, but then, you end up with a product like the laser that ends up with tremendous applications in all sorts of things, from medical surgery to, your compact disc player. I just hate to see the area of research and innovation sort of drummed down into these black and white issues of private sector good, government bad, when it's an ecosystem, and we need to acknowledge that ecosystem. It's been acknowledged from the very early founding fathers. I mean, Benjamin Franklin actually said that an investment in knowledge pays the best interest. I think it's one of my favorite quotes.
There's been a lot of comparison lately, and OSU's working to increase the revenue from research. There's a lot of comparison among the universities. Do you think that's a healthy direction or not?
Well, OSU is a world-class research university. Sure. It's obviously critically important to maintain solid advances in research funding. Mm-hmm. OSU is one of the more innovative universities in terms of how it looks at research, and with the president initiative and provost, the vice president of research, they've really focused on sort of grand global challenges and making sure that OSU is sort of firing on all cylinders in key global challenges around health and wellness and energy and the environment and a number of other areas. But I think they've positioned themselves quite well in terms of thinking about research in the future. But it's a difficult time. I mean, government funding is not growing at the pace that it had been in the past. Sequestration was a sort of blunt instrument that hit a lot of people hard. And in many respects, I've heard people say it's sort of like eating your seed corn. Innovation is America's future. It's what the country's been built on. And if you cut back on innovation, and the research that spurs innovation, you're really eating our national seed corn.
Simon Tripp, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Simon Tripp, he's the Senior Director of Battelle Technology Partnership Practice. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.